You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, humans are hardwired to avoid pain. So, how do you explain ultramarathons, chili eating contests, BDSM, and polar plunges? Your stories about what hurts so good. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, it hasn't been the greatest year of all time for air travel. That goes for passengers and air carriers. Last month, the Federal Aviation Administration reported more than 4,300 unruly passenger events so far in 2021. Nearly three quarters of those had to do with the FAA's mask mandate that went into effect in February. Incidents aren't happening as often now as they were back then, but the rate is still more than twice as high as last year. The FAA has proposed more than $1 million in fines against misbehaving passengers. As for the airlines, they've had their share of service lapses, but our guest says the federal government doesn't seem real interested in punishing them. Only two fines have been issued against major airlines. At that rate, 2021 would have the fewest enforcements in the Department of Transportation's history. Our guest says we need to fix the imbalance, and he's got some ideas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've flown over the past few months, what was it like? Did you feel like the airlines were accommodating, or was the service lacking? Did you see any bad behavior from fellow passengers? What does good airline service look like to you? If you work for an airline, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christopher Elliott is a consumer advocate, journalist, and co-founder of the advocacy group Travelers United. He's the author of the book, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler and Save Time, Money, and Hassle. He wrote in the Washington Post this week about how to improve air travel. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
A lot of attention out there on the passengers misbehaving on planes. You say there's been some misbehavior from the airlines in recent, not just months, but years. Where do you see the biggest problems in the way the industry is serving consumers?
Oh my gosh, where to even begin? Well, I mean, we should probably start with how the government is dealing with the misbehavior, because there's always been misbehavior by the airlines. Customer service has been going down ever since the airlines were deregulated during the Carter administration. We see unconscionable fees. Passengers that they spend money on fares that they eventually can't use, service lapses in the cabin. I mean, the list just goes on and on. But the reaction from the government is what I was focusing on in this story. And I've been writing this column for the Washington Post for the last 13 years. And every year at about this time, I look at the number of fines against the airlines. So the Department of Transportation has this sole authority to regulate airlines, and they also regulate customer service issues. So if something goes wrong and we complain to the DOT, they're supposed to go after the airlines and make sure that they're doing their jobs. And the number of complaints has gone up in 2020, but curiously, the number of enforcement actions by the DOT has gone down to the point now where we only have two enforcement actions so far. And that is the lowest number ever, as you mentioned at the top of the hour. And I don't know what's going to happen in the next couple of months, but something tells me this is going to be an historic year, and historic in a bad way, in the sense that we're going to see the fewest fines ever, and which means that the airlines are getting away with whatever they want to get away with.
What does it take to, if I'm an airline, to get a fine from the federal government? What rose to that level of two fines, just so we have a sense of what is too egregious?
Well, right now you have a fine against United Airlines for tarmac delays. So they left people sitting on the tarmac, and there's a rule that says you can't leave people on the tarmac for more than 2 hours without giving them the option of getting off the plane. They violated that rule repeatedly. And these were for violations that go back to 2017. So it's 2017, 2018, 2019. And then you also had a fine against JetBlue Airways. And that was a relatively minor fine. So those were just, you would think though, that with all of the people complaining that there would be more fines. And that's a really interesting thing. I've sat across from DOT officials in Washington, and I've talked to them about, what does it take? The same question that you have, what does it take to get a fine? And they say it has to be a repeated violation. It's not just a one-off. There really has to be a pattern before we're going to get involved. And if you can put this into kind of terms that we would understand as people, it would essentially mean that you get caught speeding repeatedly and you're not given a traffic fine until you've done it like 5 or 6 times. It's kind of ridiculous.
Talking to Christopher Elliott, consumer advocate, especially on issues related to travel. He's co-founder of the advocacy group Travelers United. He says the federal government needs to do more enforcement of customer service rules and other infractions by airlines. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience with an airline that you felt should have been punished by the government? Do you want to see more regulation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chris, in your piece, you pointed out different regulation standards and really a different philosophy in Europe when it comes to airline customer service. What do you see over there?
Europe has something called EU 261. It's a fairly powerful consumer protection rule. It is if you are delayed or if your flight is canceled, you have certain rights. You have a right to a refund. You have a right to the airline has to take care of you, pay for a hotel or pay for a meal. These are things that we took for granted here in the United States during deregulation. Shortly after deregulation, our airlines did this too. They don't anymore. And in Europe, they do. And so you have this disparity between Europe and the United States. One of the ideas for fixing air travel in the U.S. and making customer service better is that maybe we should have a rule that's similar to EU 261 that would really codify these rights.
One of the ideas, I believe, of deregulation, Chris, is that we're going to have more competition in airlines. We're going to have smaller, maybe regional airlines popping up. There's going to be competition. So if that airline over there drops the ball on customer service, consumers will move to the other one. It sounds like you don't think it's worked out that way. Why not?
Well, without getting too political, I will say that we're not really a competitive airline industry here. I know the airlines like to say that, but we're more of an oligopoly where we have 3 or 4 major airlines that control. I mean, if you try to fly out of, say, Chicago, you have... you know, you've got some very dominant carriers there that if you want to go somewhere, you really have a limited number of choices. Same thing for Minneapolis. You know, you've got some fortress hubs there. Delta has a big hub in Minneapolis, and so to say that there's competition is really a bit of a stretch. And that's why this is very similar to the debate that we're having now with social media and to a certain extent telecom, where some sensible and thoughtful government regulation might be very helpful to protect consumers.
You also write, Chris, that maybe fines aren't enough or fines alone aren't the answer. And some privileges and abilities to take off and land in certain places might be at stake if airlines are repeat offenders. What would that look like?
Oh, I love that idea. Yeah, this came from Charlie Leoco over at Travelers United. By way of disclosure, I helped co-found Travelers United. Charlie's idea, and he had floated this past DOT, was that maybe if fines were not working, which I don't think they are, you could do something like take away the landing slots of airlines that misbehave. Now, the FAA can do that. It doesn't need an act of Congress. It doesn't need a DOT consent order. It can take away a landing slot, and those landing slots are worth millions of dollars. So if an airline misbehaves, you can take away one of its landing slots at, you know, one of the big airports like JFK or LaGuardia or Ronald Reagan in Washington.
Talking to Christopher Elliott, sharing some ideas on improving the air travel experience and calling for a change in government regulation, more of it potentially on airlines if they don't fly right. He's a consumer advocate, journalist, and co-founder of the advocacy group Travelers United. And we want to hear your thoughts, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. If you've been flying for a long time, have you seen things change when it comes to airline service for better or for worse. Have you been surprised by a low fare, at least at first, and then fees that stack up and make it look like the other high fares you browsed right past? Do you work in air travel? What kind of changes have you seen in your industry in recent years, maybe during the pandemic? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about ways to improve airline customer service. Our guest wrote a piece for the Washington Post saying this year the federal government has come down a lot harder on unruly passengers than on the airlines themselves for their service lapses. Says we need to fix that imbalance by penalizing air carriers with more fines, maybe in other ways. He says travelers need more consumer protections. Christopher Elliott is a consumer advocate, journalist, and co-founder of the group Travelers United, author of the book How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you fly, if you do it often or from time to time, what have you seen? Do you feel like airlines can get away with a lot and you just got to take what they give you if you want to use their business? Would you like to see more regulation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Chris, I wanted to bring up the troublesome passenger issue. You want to see more from airlines and how they prepare for that, prevent it, and deal with it. What could they do better?
I think improved training is a good idea. Flight attendants are put in kind of a difficult position right now because they've gone from being flight attendants and knowing what they have to do to becoming the mask police. And I think that that is a problem. The real question is, though, what do you do? I mean, how do you enforce the masks? Is it something that all the other passengers are going to have to start doing now? Or what do you do? Sometimes they will come through the cabin and give people red cards if they're not wearing their masks properly, and they'll kick them off. That's where most of these confrontations are happening, is that people are getting into fights over masks. Better training can definitely fix that. Ultimately, though, they have to stop having a mask rule on the plane. That's something that's only going to happen over time.
Are you looking for that to happen sooner or later? That would have to come from the FAA, of course, not from the airlines.
Yeah, FAA, CDC, exactly. I think that we're heading in the right direction. I mean, you hear that's being said a lot. But I think that once we get to a certain number of cases, there are already some airlines out there that have stopped forcing people to wear masks on the plane. I mean, look, the real issue here is not even the masks are just a symptom of the bigger problem. The airlines have taken $80 billion in aid from taxpayers. And what we're left with is this really difficult air travel experience where passengers are beating up on each other, beating up on flight attendants. Something really has to happen. The real question is what?
Talking to Christopher Elliott about air travel now and in the future. You can join in at 800-642 with your thoughts, your maybe experiences with a troublesome or a smooth flying experience. Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wanted to ask about fees, Chris. You mentioned that earlier. We see these kind of teaser rates for a airplane ticket, perhaps, but a lot of surprises along the way. What would you like to see change with that?
Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, it was a little bit worse before the pandemic because you had these ridiculous change fees. But airlines are not making money by flying passengers anymore. And I'm only being a little bit facetious here. Their entire business model is based on fees. And so what you have is they're trying to lure you in with a very low fee or a low fare rather, and then they're adding fees to that fare. For example, you know, if you want to board early, you have to pay extra. If you want to have a seat reservation, you have to pay extra. If you want to make a ticket change, some tickets still have those fees, and they can be quite high. They're not in any way related to the cost of doing things like changing the flight. They're all based on how much money people are willing to pay. So it's a real free market here for fees. And people are fatigued by these fees. They really just want to be able to go look at a ticket price and then pay that price. And then that includes all the things that they're used to paying for with an airline ticket. For example, the ability to bring a bag on the plane. I mean, some airlines now, specifically the low fare carriers, will charge you to bring a personal item onto the plane. So a laptop computer, for example, or a small bag, they will force you to pay extra for that. And that just seems a little bit outrageous.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bridget is with us in Oconomowoc. Bridget, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What's your story, Bridget?
My story is that I am a student travel leader. I'm a high school teacher, and I'm a student. I take students to foreign countries, and we had a really great experience with one of the European airlines when I had about 25 students, and after spending a week and a half in Spain, on the way back, we were bumped off of our flight because of a mechanical problem with the airplane. And because we were bumped, like about 50 people were bumped off the plane because they had to take a smaller plane, the airline honored that European rule that you were talking about a little while ago. And not only did we get a hotel and transportation to the hotel from the Madrid airport, we also got dinner and breakfast next morning. And then in addition to that, that rule also forced the airline to pay each passenger that was bumped. So each one of my high school students got an extra 700 euro, about $500, because of the distance that we were flying from Madrid back to Chicago. And that rule like kicked in that payment based on the distance you flew. And, you know, I still had three teenagers who felt they had to be back, you know, that day. So they were crying. But most of us said, wow, this like totally helped us, even though we had to stay an extra night in Madrid. Gosh, what a terrible thing that is.
Yeah, no kidding.
but it was like that made the inconvenience and the fact that we had to like then change our bus to pick us up in Chicago an extra day. But, I mean, we didn't care because we just each got paid about $500 to stay overnight.
Bridget, thanks a lot for that call. Chris, if it had been a domestic trip within the United States, they would have gotten pretty much none of that, right?
No, if it was a mechanical delay, they might have gotten a hotel, but they wouldn't have gotten paid. And, yeah, unfortunately, that rule doesn't exist in the United States. And as I noted in the article in the Washington Post, it would be great if they did for mechanical delays, especially, or for cancellation.
Thanks for that call, Bridget. We'll go to Elizabeth now in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. My sister's a flight attendant for a major airline, and the stories I hear are just, she's very stressed out, especially with the mask issue, although they do, they can issue those cards. People being rude, people, having advances toward the flight attendants, all kinds of things. And they do get trained every year. I don't know if people are aware, but they do go through extensive training every single year. So I'm curious what the speaker or the guest means by more training. I mean, I don't know what more training means. If you have people that are rude and don't want to follow the rules because they're acting like little children, what's more training going to do with it?
Thanks for the call, Elizabeth. Chris?
By better training, I actually was talking to someone about this who was also an expert. Certainly self-defense training, and I think a lot of flight attendants they're taking matters into their own hands now and doing self-defense training on their own just because they don't want to become a victim. I might push back a little gently on saying that passengers are acting like children. Certainly some of them are, but a lot of them are really just fed up by the overall flying experience. You have to remember that these people and, the caller's sister probably knows this better than anyone, are being put into a cabin, a pressurized aluminum cabin, where the seats have been moved closer and closer together. So they're a little bit like rats in a maze. They're frustrated and confused. Then you force them to put a mask on their face so they feel even more constricted. Then you tell them that they have to pay for their food and their drinks. Some of them can't afford that. So they are deprived of food and drink, deprived of personal space. Then maybe the person in front of them leans back into their own personal space. It is a powder keg waiting to go off. Unfortunately, the flight attendants have to deal with that. It's not fair to the attendants. And I think that was the point that I was trying to make in the story.
Thanks a lot for that call. Ultimately, Chris, people keep flying despite the conditions you're talking about, despite the hidden fees. So there's no incentive for from consumers, apparently, for airlines to change this behavior, is there?
Well, right now, there is no incentive, really. I mean, you've given the airlines $80 billion in federal aid. So you've really given, they're being treated very well by the government. And but you do also see people are driving a lot. I mean, 9 out of every 10 vacations is taken by car. And that actually went up during the pandemic. So people did kind of avoid flying. You can see the airlines didn't do very well financially because people were avoiding flying. But still, there should be some kind of an incentive to do better. And I think if you're going to give an industry $80 billion in aid, it should come with some strings attached. This aid came with virtually no strings attached.
Chris, in our last half a minute or so, are you optimistic that, say, the Department of Transportation is going to become more proactive on these issues anytime soon?
I don't see any evidence. I had hoped that during this administration, it would become a little bit more proactive. It actually hasn't. Things have stayed just about the same. I think people are going to have to take this to court and litigate it in order to get any changes.
We'll leave it there, Chris. Thanks again for joining us today.
No problem.
That's Christopher Elliott, consumer advocate, journalist, and co-founder of the advocacy group Travelers United. We talked to him today about how to make the airlines more accountable for poor service and improve their customer service as well. Still time for you to share your air travel stories, good or bad. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, new maps are in the works for Wisconsin elections. We'll check out the Republican redistricting maps out this week, the People's Map Commission's plans, and how they collide with each other. Plus, it's Food Friday with one of the most versatile foods around, the potato. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at the controversies surrounding school boards in Wisconsin and around the country. Plus, protests, recall efforts, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a congressional committee investigating the January 6th insurrection wants to see documents from the Trump administration, but former President Trump says they're protected by executive privilege. We'll take a closer look at the claims and find out what's covered by executive privilege and what isn't. First, school boards around the country are finding themselves in the middle of controversy and sometimes heated debates. Among them are mask mandates and other COVID policies, race, and sexuality. Wisconsin is a big flashpoint for these conversations. For example, in Waukesha, the school district says it believes in diversity and individual differences, but the school board there has since banned certain classroom displays like Black Lives Matter posters or rainbow flags because they say they're political and encourage advocacy. Since the pandemic began, angry parents have shown up at school board meetings to express their displeasure with their kids' learning environments. Some ran for school board, some won. In fact, Wisconsin's attempted more recalls of school board members during the pandemic than every other state except California. Around the country, thousands of school board seats will be up for grabs next month, and Wisconsin school board elections are held in spring. Meanwhile, some are worried that the conservative push is undoing some key supports for underrepresented students. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the story in your community, in the schools around you? Do you generally think your local school board gets things right or wrong? Have you become more engaged with your kids' education during the pandemic? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Aaron Richards is a Milwaukee-based national education reporter at USA Today. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks.
We see headlines about one school or another again and again. You've been following this issue closely, Aaron. How widespread are these flare-ups around school boards around the country?
Well, it's quite widespread because we've seen a lot of flare-ups politically around everything else tied to COVID as well, and schools are in the middle of that. So a lot of this were, you know, parents watching their kids at home on Zoom and knowing more about what their kids were learning or maybe not learning. School boards became the place where people could go and talk publicly about whether they felt that schools should be open or closed, masks should be used or not. So many, you know, the school board meetings were on Zoom for so much of the pandemic that it made it easier for people to just jump online and participate. And of course, those have escalated now. Many more meetings have been in person. The COVID rules have activated a number of parents. And then in the middle of all this, we started to hear more about critical race theory, which we can get into that a little bit more. It's a legal term to look at the influence of racism in society and embedded in institutions. And there's strong feelings on the conservative side that this isn't something that actually happens in real life, and they don't want K-12 schools to be teaching that. K-12 schools really don't teach that theory specifically, but they do and have been for years moving toward more practices that research and experts say are good to make kids feel included in schools. So that's where some of the push now with parents getting riled up about COVID protocols and then about critical race theory. And now some of these changes are happening because parents, many of them conservative, have run for the board, they've gotten on, and now they have power to make real changes. And it's you can make changes much faster at the local level in your school board than you sometimes can, you know, at the state and certainly at the federal level.
Let's talk about critical race theory, the rise of this as a buzzword in these protests against schools. Is this something that spontaneously arose one district at a time, or was there a coordinated effort to bring this out as an issue?
We really saw this explode when a couple of conservative organizations and one guy in particular named Chris Rufo, who's now at the Manhattan Institute, started coming up with examples of what he thought was critical race theory happening in schools. And, you know, there have been lots of news articles about the wrong way to teach about racism, for example, you know, slave trade recreations in school and whatnot. Those are not seen as good steps to teach kids how to understand race and racism in America. But really, the push started when this particular author, Chris Rufo, was coming up with examples of this and saying that this was embedded in all the institutions of the federal government. Fox News put a big spotlight on it near the end of Trump's presidency. And former President Donald Trump had basically said that all federal contractors were no longer required or could no longer be forced to do diversity and equity training, which is something pretty common in workplaces and in schools, has been for years. But that really kind of triggered the backlash. This was also coinciding with the backlash to the New York Times 1619 Project, which retold the history of America through the lens of slavery and its impact on American institutions. So this has really been snowballing, and then it's come together with all of these agitations around COVID protocols, which are also can be very politically polarizing, even though science is sort of getting lost in the middle sometimes. And so it's really kind of coalesced into real changes now, because you can get on your school board, you can run pretty easily, and you can make a lot of impact at your local level. And that's what a lot of these parents are doing now. And there is a feeling on the right that their views are underrepresented in schools, and that schools shouldn't be discussing things like gender and sexuality and kind of recognizing that or celebrating it. And so it's become as much of a culture clash between different points of political view on this as it has about, you know, good teaching and learning and practices.
Talking to Aaron Richards, national education reporter for USA Today, looking at controversies facing school boards on issues of how race and American history should be taught over COVID, mask mandates, and more. Recalls going on here in Wisconsin in school boards, elsewhere in the country as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you on a school board? What kind of things are you seeing? Is it getting heated from time to time? What do you think about the issues that are generating this controversy? How we teach about race, the mask mandates in schools, distance learning, and things like that. Do you think your local school board got it right or wrong, or as right as they could under the circumstances? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Aaron, recalls. We've got some coming up or efforts underway in Wisconsin. We see some elsewhere in the country. What kind of things are you seeing?
Right. Well, one of the biggest and most highly watched ones is a recall campaign in the Mequon-Thiensville School District, which, of course, is just north of Milwaukee. There are a number of suburban moms who have been activated by both the the critical race theory debates and wanting to have more of a conservative representation on their board. And they've gathered enough signatures to force a recall election. Most school board elections are in the spring in Wisconsin. And these moms are very passionate about what they're doing. I went to one of their presentations in Milwaukee in September, and there is some misinformation about what they think is happening in their schools. I know that there's some talk about Mequon scores dropping for students. Mequon-Thiensville is still one of the highest performing school districts in the state. It's highly desirable to be in that district and to go to that high school. So I'm not clear on exactly what they hope would get a whole lot better in Mequon-Thiensville, but they've certainly activated a lot of their community members, and they feel like their voices need to be heard on the board. So it's very interesting because it's very much a microcosm of Wisconsin's split politics. We are a swing state, and this is really playing out in these local school board elections. And it could be a harbinger. Maybe this is the moment where Republicans do have a lot more energy and can sort of win at these local levels and then take that energy to win statewide and national elections and midterms.
And at least some of these cases, including, I think, in Mequon-Thiensville, Republican political action committees are helping fund the recall efforts. And I believe yes. A Republican candidate for governor was recruiting some of those local candidates. Do I have that right?
Yes, there has been, of course, the interplay between the national political groups and the state political groups. The folks in Mequon do have help from some of the political operatives, which, of course, gives you a leg up in just running against your average parent. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. Mm-hmm. It just means that there's more energy there than we've ever really seen before or lately in these, you know, otherwise fairly sleepy school board elections.
We're talking about how school boards around the country are dealing with controversial issues in recent weeks and months. Aaron Richards is with us, national education reporter for USA Today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you paying attention to the school board in your community, maybe more so than you did in years past? Have there been heated, controversial moments, or are things working smoothly where you are? If you're on a school board, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues. We'll hear from some of you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about controversies facing school boards around the country, including here in Wisconsin, with decisions on masks, how to teach race and history, and more. Protests in some cases, recall elections in others. Aaron Richards is with us, national education reporter for USA Today, based in Milwaukee. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Laura is with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi, I'm calling in because I've been paying close attention to this in my community. I'm not on a school board, but I've been observing the meetings and seeing, you know, the anti-CRT signs pop up around town and seeing neighbors really being, you know, turning against their own neighbors. And I just want to add to this conversation the fact that, you know, in these small communities, much of this hysteria over, you know, the anti-masking or the masking and the anti-CRT is coming from outside the community. And I'm not just talking about people from other communities, you know, coming in the night of the school board meeting and causing disruption, though that is indeed happening. But, for example, in Manitowoc, the local Republicans have been inviting this Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is the organization that dismantled the teachers union on behalf of Scott Walker. Those lawyers have been coming in, you know, they'll set up at a local hotel upon invitation by the local Republicans, and all the local Republicans will attend these meetings where these lawyers just really whip up the crowd, and they say the most outlandish things, and the people that are attending believe this. For example, at the last meeting, the attorney that was presenting said, you know, you need to stop these liberal teachers. He actually handed out a form that parents can use to hand out to the teachers, and this form is designed to intimidate the teachers, and what it asks is for the teacher to report back to the parent anytime they they teach on any one of the catch terms, you know, equity or equality or anything like that, that the right has identified as CRT terminology. And the lawyer said, the reason you want the teachers to fill his paperwork out is so you can identify who the liberal teachers are and stop them, because they are injecting young girls with testosterone and forcing young girls to have abortions. He said that literally in those words. So,
Laura, thanks for the call. So Laura is seeing this. Aaron, are we seeing this kind of coordinated effort? I don't know about the specific claim toward the end there, but is this something that is happening in a lot of communities?
We have seen a number of high-powered conservative organizations guide parents on this topic. The Heritage Foundation, for example, has a toolkit to be a woke parent, but it's kind of in quotes. And it's, you know, it's how to file records requests and how to ask if your school is teaching CRT. To the caller's point about the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, Will is located in Milwaukee. They're funded by the Bradley Foundation, and they have a very conservative viewpoint, and they exist to essentially file and fight lawsuits that are in the conservative causes. So that's why they're very keyed into this right now. And it is effective. I don't know if there's an equivalent liberal law team that's quite as prevalent as they are, but they've been around for a long time. They file a lot of lawsuits around schools issues and school choice issues. So in broad strokes, though, there is a lot of coordination both between state organizations like this that are conservative and the national conservative organizations, in part because there's a lot of emotion here. And there's a lot, there's probably voters that may be on the fence that would be compelled to agree with the Republicans on this. So there is a lot of strategy and coordination. Again, nothing illegal about it, but some of the messaging is not always accurate either.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Christopher now in Kenosha. Christopher, hi.
Hello. I just had a question about critical race theory and teaching it in schools and how I think it should be a requirement and how I don't really understand why it's opposed so much. Humans have evolved to recognize patterns and make predictions. And if we just turn a blind eye into what the circumstances are that have produced, you know, these underprivileged neighborhoods that are, you know, have high concentrations of minorities due to redlining and other systemic issues, and just leave it up to people to, you know, come to their own conclusions, they're going to find a pattern, and that pattern is going to be minority or black person or violence, so forth.
Christopher, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. A little hard to make it out, Aaron, but Christopher, talking about how to teach about these issues, you did a whole piece actually on how schools typically try to, and the recommendations for how to teach about historical issues of racial inequality, like redlining, as our caller mentioned. What kind of things did you hear from experts?
Right. So they actually say that good teaching about racism and racism in the United States does include voices from people who were enslaved and voices from people who are not just the white majority. That is part of what's driving some of the controversy, is that many conservatives or people who liked the traditional text feel like the white narrative is being crowded out a bit by more diverse voices. There's lots of people that say that's a good thing, including education researchers, because we're always learning more about history and we're always trying to gather more information from different sides about how it felt and how it played out for different types of people. And to the caller's point too about making critical race theory a requirement, there is a number of people on the left that think that there should be a bigger pushback to this, to say, yes, like we do have racism embedded in institutions. Now, again, many conservatives don't believe that. They believe that racism exists, but not that it's embedded in an institution in a baked in way. We did some polling at USA Today this fall, back to school polling. And what was interesting is that 2 out of 3 parents overall actually believe that schools should teach the ongoing effects of racism in America, the ongoing effects of slavery, what's still lingering from that time that affects society today. That's really what critical race theory is. But if you ask parents, well, do you think it's okay to teach about critical race theory? Then it drops down to about 50% of parents. So some of this is just the messaging around this, that term has a lot of kind of negative overtones to it. So it tends to get people riled up. But most parents in our polling believe that we should be talking about the ongoing effects of slavery. And we've certainly done lots of stories that, you know, our paper and others that say, you know, the Black family that tries to sell their house and their photos are, you know, of their family, they get a much lower offer much lower appraisal price than when they took all their neighbors' family photos and their neighbors are white, they hang those up instead and then they get a much higher offer. So again, to the caller's point, research is pretty strong that people do have some individual biases, but there is a lot of resistance on the right to the assertion that, you know, we are inherently a racist society.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Aaron Richards, education reporter for USA Today, about controversies facing school boards. Back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Menominee. Scott, hi.
Hi. No, I was just going to make a point. I think previous callers kind of hit on a lot of things. But then here out in Menominee, we had a controversy with the book that was discussed in one of the schools was I Am Malala. And, of course, you know, that includes somebody that was, I think, Malala or was a Muslim. And that got quite a lot of attention from the local, you know, Republicans, basically. But, yeah, the coordination, I do have a lot of concern that it's kind of scary because it doesn't seem like it's just a general grassroots thing. When you got people with yard signs under their Trump signs, they've got their unmask, their our kids signs and such things as that going on.
Scott, thanks for the call. He mentioned a Malala book. Aaron, anecdotally, I've seen children's books about Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King blocked at least temporarily from schools. Children's book authors' speeches canceled. A principal fired in Texas, I think it was, over accusations that he had violated the state's guidelines on teaching about race. Are we seeing this affect what and who kids see in their schools?
Right. And the... to this point, too, there's been a big resurgence in book banning and parents kind of looking at some of the literature in their kids' libraries or the school libraries and thinking that they're too explicit. This often happens around books that have themes of queerness or gay and lesbian themes. There are some heated feelings about that. But in other cases, it does seem like it's gotten a little bit out of hand. There's a school board in Central York up in Pennsylvania that had banned a list of books by Black authors and other minority voices and other resources for a year. Students weren't supposed to be using these resources. And I think one of them included the book Hidden Figures, which was a very popular movie about, you know, women that contributed essentially to the space race whose narratives hadn't been told. And so I think that there's a lot of, again, there's lots of organizing around parent Facebook groups for this, conservative parent groups. There's, you know, I interviewed a guy for this last story who said, look, a lot of this is coming out of QAnon chat rooms because QAnon has now become much more mainstream. It's kind of become part of the conservative ideology. And so a lot of these ideas are shared quickly, and we're seeing these same things in school boards around the country because there's a lot more coordination and talking online. Many of us aren't completely back to our full outside the house lives yet. So there's been plenty of time for people to kind of, you know, read about what's happening elsewhere and follow the same pattern in their local school district.
In just our last half a minute or so, Aaron, what are you watching for next on this story you've been following so closely?
Yeah, I'm doing a follow-up piece that tries to highlight kid voices about what, for example, taking down signage in the classroom that's inclusive. What does that mean? What does that mean for you and your learning experience? Does that change the teachers you approach? Does it make you feel less safe in school? Really trying to highlight those because I think what's really been lost in this entire debate is how kids feel. And some of the testimony at school board meetings that comes from middle school and high school students is very compelling. And I think that we need to all be listening a little bit more to them sometimes and not get quite as wrapped up in some of our adult political battles.
Aaron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Aaron Richards is a national education reporter for USA Today based in Milwaukee. We talked to her about the many controversies facing school boards in Wisconsin and around the country, including mask mandates and other COVID measures, sexuality, and the teaching of race and history. Coming up after the news, former President Donald Trump is fighting an attempt by lawmakers to investigate the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol, citing executive privilege. We'll talk to a legal expert about how that secrecy power works for presidents of the United States and what its limitations are. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.